The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursdays at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with your host, Don Olson, along with Dave Gutnick. And we try and present things which are of vital importance. And we've been doing that all year long. We've been doing a lot on the Ukraine, why that whole thing is all bizarre. But today we're going to do Max Blumenthal is going to do a report on Charlie Kirk on the Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano. Now there's Star Tribune today had an article about Russia, China moved to explain Kirk's death and all these internet whatever's, including Iran, of course. But Max Blumenthal is someone that we've known for years. He's been a longtime commentator and researcher for things on especially Middle East things, especially on Israel, but also things in this country, too.
You can find them on The Gray Zone, along with other good journalists.
He's the editor-in-chief of The Gray Zone, and it's a good place to go to find out a lot of things. So this will be a little bit, this will be entirely different than anything what I've heard yet, and it goes back a little bit, a month or two ago, for about Charlie Kirk and what had gone on. So we'll talk a bit more about it coming up.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Monday, September 15th, 2025. Max Blumenthal is here with a report of his latest investigations on the events leading up to the murder of Charlie Kirk. Max, you've been doing unbelievable investigative reporting. What have you learned?
Well, following my September 12th report, which provided background about the pressure, the mounting pressure that Charlie Kirk was under from pro-Israel forces, from Netanyahu's cutouts in the United States, I gathered more details. The piece, it hit like a sledgehammer. It really caused a lot of, I think it spoke for a lot of people, particularly within the conservative movement, which is changing among the youth on the question of Israel. And more people started coming out, and more people started talking, and people were talking to me. And these were people who had knowledge of a tumultuous, stormy meeting held in the Hamptons during the first week of August, convened, according to multiple sources, with knowledge of this meeting, intimate knowledge of this meeting, by the billionaire ultra-Zionist financier Bill Ackman, who's close to Netanyahu and his kind of network in the United States. Charlie Kirk was summoned along with an array of young, sort of vapid, very avaricious conservative influencers who seemed to be sort of in Israel's back pocket, to set a very pro-Israel tone for this meeting. And Charlie Kirk was, according to one source, hammered by Ackman and others for allowing Israel critics, very prominent conservative voices like Megyn Kelly, Tucker Carlson, or the anti-Zionist Jewish comedian Dave Smith, to appear at his events. And actually, Charlie Kirk was planning to host many of these same figures again in December, and he had just added to his TPUSA major, I think it's called America Fest in December, the premier critic of Israel in Congress. I didn't say Republican critic, I just said premier critic, because that's what she is now, Marjorie Taylor Greene, which really reflected his shifting views. And Ackman, according to multiple sources, had this meeting to basically bully Charlie Kirk into submission. Charlie Kirk walked away, according to one person, feeling like there was an attempt to blackmail him. He refused any offers of funding and also refused the offer to travel to Israel and meet with Netanyahu, which Netanyahu disclosed in the wake, the immediate wake of Netanyahu's death. He talked about this letter, but he didn't say whether Charlie Kirk refused or accepted. I've learned since that he refused. And then beyond that, he was becoming so alienated by this crowd of pro-Israel enforcers that he was moving away from the Protestant church. This is what I've been told. Candace Owens just disclosed this on her live stream. And, you know, he was a Protestant who, as a young conservative voice, and, you know, I believe an evangelical Christian.
Yeah, he was a Christian nationalist by his own words.
Yes, and he was pushing the idea of this Judeo-Christian alliance, and that was like music to the ears of the pro-Israel funders. But right. Now he was starting to attend Catholic Mass with his wife, Erica, and moving in a different direction, what Candace Owens called a spiritual transformation. And the Catholics just don't have that same conceptualization of American Christian nationalism and the Judeo-Christian alliance.
Correct.
This has never been, I don't think it's been reported before. So he was undergoing a transformation, a singular figure in the Trump world, unreplaceable, sort of a unique figure in that world. And he was moving on this question, and there really wasn't anything they could do to stop him. Because you couldn't just, I mean, I'm sure there would have been an attempt, and there already was, through figures like Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin at Fox News, to attack him and sort of suggest maybe he should be removed. But you can't really just remove someone like that who's built this entire gigantic infrastructure around himself. So we really don't know where things would have gone. But these two stories together, I think, paint a picture of it's a wider history of where the conservative movement itself is going, right. And the kind of the astroturfing from pro-Israel one percenters to prevent that.
This will undermine Trump's support on this issue substantially. So his good buddy, the Vice President of the United States, is a Catholic convert. Candace Owens is a Catholic convert. Mrs. Kirk is a born and raised Roman Catholic. This probably terrified the Christian nationalists, the Mike Huckabee types, and their wealthy American, mainly New York, Zionist financiers. Do we know from your sources what Kirk himself thought of Netanyahu? Did he feel intimidated by Netanyahu?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the reason that people initially started talking to me was that Netanyahu came out while Charlie Kirk's body was still warm and started lying about him and trying to recast him as his best friend. Now, it's true. Right. Charlie Kirk was, until fairly recently, certainly before October 7th, 2023, the most important Gentile asset that Israel might have had today, possibly more important than Trump, because Charlie Kirk was preaching the pro-Israel gospel to young people, and he was potentially on his way to becoming president or senator, someone very important to Israel. So he, as soon as he starts to make some noises after October 7th about Israel's misdeeds, but particularly about Israel's malign influence in Washington, and then he experienced the pressure from pro-Israel donors like Bill Ackman, Netanyahu enters the picture. And Charlie Kirk, according to a longtime friend of his, who I spoke to, considered Netanyahu a disgusting bully who is a manipulator and was fundamentally dishonest. And this stands at complete odds with the picture Netanyahu has tried to paint in not just one, but I think five or maybe six tweets since Charlie Kirk was killed. And additionally, I mean, I think it's important to recognize what Netanyahu was doing. He was trying to do the same thing he did after 9/11, when the Israeli publication Ma'ariv reported in 2008 that Netanyahu said 9/11 is good for Israel. And he thought that he wanted to exploit Charlie Kirk's killing in a way that benefited Israel by pushing a narrative of religious warfare and Islamophobia inside the U.S. And he blamed Islam and radical Muslims and the left for killing Charlie Kirk before the suspect was even known, before anyone had even been caught. And so the truth and the reality about Charlie Kirk's relationship with Netanyahu turns Netanyahu's whole sectarian, militaristic narrative on its head.
Here's Charlie Kirk in August talking to Megyn Kelly, my friend and former colleague, about the people that are attacking him. Chris, cut number 14.
I think I have a bulletproof resume showing my defense of Israel, both on campus, on social media, to great, you know, let's just say mockery and scorn at times, where I believe it. However, Megyn, you're hitting on something very potent and important. Now, let me first say, I don't want to judge an entire group, because there's been many people in the pro-Israel world that have been very sweet, very kind, very nuanced, very Charlie, you know, you're with us, you don't have to agree all the time. However, and I will say this, the behavior by a lot, both privately and publicly, are pushing people like you and me away. My moral character is now being put into question, Megyn. Not my decisions. Not like, hey, are you doing this? Is it smart or is it dumb? But no, I am a bad person if I do this. And I could go, I mean, you saw it, Megyn. It was trending on Twitter, thousands of tweets and text messages. And if I were to be charitable and generous, I will say, the people that are attacking me are in a hyper-paranoid state because they're at war, and war tends to make things black and white. And you're a hammer looking for a nail. So I'm trying to be charitable, Megyn. Literally, I'm trying to cut as much slack as I can, right? I have less ability sometimes online to criticize the Israeli government about backlash than actual Israelis do. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really weird, isn't it, Megyn?
It's not right.
Personality types like you, myself, and Tucker, the more that you guys privately and publicly call our character into question, which is not isolated, right? Megyn, it would be one thing if it was one text or two texts. It is dozens of texts. When the hostile reaction is that now Megyn and Charlie are enemies,
right?
Boy, I'll tell you, like, you're not gonna. I wouldn't say lose, but you will weaken and just basically deflate two of your strongest advocates if that continues.
Right about the time that he was summoned to the Hamptons by Ackman and company.
Yeah, I believe that was August 6th when he said that. I struggled to pinpoint the precise date of the meeting, but it was right around that time because I managed to dredge up Instagram photos from some of the influencers who I confirmed to be at the meeting, especially photos by someone named Xavier de Rousseau, who I'd say very few people watching this have probably heard of.
No, I never heard of him.
I hadn't heard much about him before. I reached him on the phone. Like everyone else who attended this meeting that I reached, he was flustered, freaked out by my call, immediately like went silent. He was in a kind of in a state of panic. They're all nervous about being identified with this meeting. Xavier de Rousseau is a employee of PragerU, which is this conservative indoctrination outlet that focuses on youth, including young people. Like
this is another Christian nationalist gaggle.
Run by Marissa Strait, who is a Jewish Zionist who served in Israel's Unit 8200 cyber spying division.
Oh, boy.
And Xavier de Rousseau was sent with Israeli government money to a Gaza Humanitarian Foundation site 2 weeks after that meeting in the Hamptons, where he mocked the famine in Gaza in very disgusting fashion, said Hamas leaders are on Ozempic because they're getting so fat off all the food they're getting. And that's his role. That's the role of many of the other influencers who are sent there, and kind of like, that's what Charlie Kirk was surrounded by there, along with Bill Ackman, who apparently organized this entire thing, who has been, just since October 7th, strong-arming his way through institutions across this country to bully them into pro-Israel submission. And apparently his next target was Charlie Kirk because of what Charlie Kirk was doing at TPUSA, specifically allowing Tucker Carlson to come on stage and referring to Bill Ackman as a Jeffrey Epstein associate who was a scam artist and a charlatan who had made his money through nebulous means. And so it all kind of fits together.
Why do you think USD, who felt the need to go on national television and expressly deny that Israel assassinated Kirk? I mean, who does that?
Yeah. Why do millions of people, I mean, you see it all over social media, they think Israel had some involvement because of the way they've been conducting themselves around the world and the region. Netanyahu's not just waging a seven-front war. He's carrying out an assassination spree in broad daylight all across the region, including inside a U.S. ally. And you have this record of Charlie Kirk, which backs up everything I heard on background, going out in public. And I mean, you can see he's anguished. He's angry. He's almost like on the verge of going crazy because he's under so much pressure from Netanyahu's cutouts in the United States. So, you know, people are taking the reality and to another level where it's an unsubstantiated theory. I have no evidence that Israel had any role in Charlie Kirk's assassination, but they're taking it there because of what they know about Israel and its capabilities and its ruthlessness, and along with the fact that the official story just keeps collapsing and is so murky and filled with contradictions that no one knows really what to make of any of this.
So this is Max Blumenthal, who's the editor-in-chief of The Gray Zone, longtime investigator, reporter, writer, and has played many of the shows many years in the past, not so much lately, on the Judging Freedom at Judge Napolitano. And this was posted last Monday on September 15th.
Can't remember whether he gets into it later, but one of the other things I have myself watched a couple times from different interviews and social media that Charlie Kirk appeared on that was quickly putting him in disfavor with the pro-Israel forces. One was expressing grave doubts about the genocide going on in Gaza. You know, he wasn't able to support that for obvious reasons. And secondly, he expressed very clear doubts about what happened on October 7th, 2023, because he said he'd been to that border area. It is the most extremely surveilled and guarded territory anywhere you can imagine. And he said he was sure, he didn't know why or from where, but a stand-down order had been issued so that the attack could take place across the border. Well, obviously, this is extremely controversial. It's also my own view that the attack was allowed to happen. Netanyahu and Israel's society was on the brink of civil war, and he was in big trouble. And it's often said, when you're in deep trouble as a political leader, you go to war.
Yes, at the October 7th affair, there were many Israeli troops, IDF, Israeli army, were sent to the north. Of course, there were doing bad things there to the Palestinians in the West Bank, but people who are on the wall, the Israeli watchtowers, everything which did go on that day on October 7th, they were practicing machines or kites or ways of flying over the wall and on and on.
Numerous guards, mostly female, complained bitterly that their warnings were repeatedly made and repeatedly ignored.
And yet, there's never been an investigation by the Israelis of what happened on October 7th, 23. And it keeps being put off by Netanyahu because, well, the war is going on. Got to get the hostages back. Or I'm having these court cases going on. Whatever the excuse. There's never been an investigation which would go into that. But certainly a lot of us have our suspicions.
And would undermine many of the drastic hysterical claims made also about mass rapes and beheaded babies, and also ignoring that many Israelis were killed by the Israelis themselves that day.
Also known as the Samson Doctrine.
They didn't want any hostages to be taken, so they killed both the kidnappers and their own citizens.
And this is something that Max Blumenthal did report back when, because he had a lot of contacts in the throughout Israeli society. And so anything which can be used to portray the Palestinians, the Gazans, in a bad manner.
Meanwhile, Israel continues to be on the verge of extreme civil war or breakdown or disputes. You know, they're having trouble keeping it together.
There's been a fair amount of non-compliance with the mobilization of Israeli reservists for this war going into Gaza City, which is, I mean, it's just pathetic, and the whole world is watching a genocide happen. It's, and I'm glad finally France and England and I think the Netherlands, they're going to declare statehood for the Palestinians. Of course, they, once you know it, some Israelis are blaming this movement for the genocide going on. And but for that declaration of having a Palestinian state, there wouldn't be this genocide. Well, that's a bunch of hooey balooey. And it, but one, if you throw out enough explanations, some people will pick it up. And of course, most countries, still led by the United States, keep sending arms and munitions to the state of Israel.
But increasingly, other countries are cutting off relations or restricting trade and the like, so they're finding, Israel is finding themselves increasingly isolated, which is key to any way out of this ugly situation.
So let's go back to Max Blumenthal on Monday on Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano on his report on Charlie Kirk.
From your sources, if Kirk believed that President Trump was frightened of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, I don't know what Kirk thought, and I've never met him, even though I've been following him for about 10 years. One of my sources knows people in the White House. I mean, the Trump White House is very accessible, I should say. I mean, I've gotten sources in there, like very good sources. And I can tell you some of the things that they've been saying, but this one particular source has said that, and this is something I've been hearing around Trump's circle, for years. Trump was always afraid of assassination because of all the attacks that he was under, because he was always compared to Hitler and so on. Then he faces a real assassination attempt. So, of course, he's afraid of that. He's very afraid of Netanyahu and his capabilities. And during one of Netanyahu's many trips to Washington this year, Israeli agents placed electronic devices on Secret Service emergency response vehicles on two separate occasions. This is what source told me with very
good. And did the Secret Service arrest these Israeli agents?
They found the devices. And this is what I was told by a Trump insider. So I can't call up, if I called up the Secret Service and asked them to confirm this, they just wouldn't even acknowledge it. It's not something that's going to happen. But there's a precedent there. The precedent is in 2019, three high-ranking former U.S. officials told Politico that Israel had done the exact same thing, placing Stingray cell phone surveillance devices around the White House and in sensitive locations throughout Washington to surveil Donald Trump's phone communications. Now, who would get access to those locations, first of all? You can't just send, Shlomo Mossad up in there. He's not going to get access. But Benjamin Netanyahu has access and his own security team. And actually, in 2017, Boris Johnson, the former Israeli prime minister, wrote in his memoir that Netanyahu went into his personal toilet and left a surveillance device, a listening device, that British security, his personal security, found a listening device after Netanyahu used his personal toilet. This was reported in the Telegraph, the British Telegraph, which is a pro-Israel publication. So I would have just dismissed this, but there's just such a strong precedent there. And it frightens people inside the White House when you have this foreign intelligence agency, which is carrying out a genocide, which can basically funds your campaigns through cutouts like Miriam Adelson. Netanyahu's calling it into the White House, demanding personnel changes all the time. That's what I've heard. And you think you can defy them and not provide them weapons when they are in this war that they think is the most important existential war in the history of Israel? No, you can't just do that. So it stands to reason that Trump is afraid, and that's what I was told by an insider with access to Trump.
It's quite enlightening what we have here. And today, of course, is day two of our pledge drive here at KFAI. And this show, Northern Sun, with myself, Don Olson, and Dave Gudnick here, we have presented all sorts of information, which is outside of the normal what's going on in the news media in this country. And it's I was really astounded when I heard this, I listened to it on Tuesday. So this was, something that really been well researched and had been done. So this is the time you can call to support 612-375-9030 or kfai.org. And this is how we do it. We most of you know that Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been wiped out by the Trump administration. So we really have to make up more money from people out there who are listening. So 612-375-9030. Dave, unless you have something to say, we'll go back to Max Blumenthal.
Go ahead.
Going to come out on all this? I mean, you've been researching this since Charlie was murdered for 4 days now.
Well, it's not just, it's after I put out the first story, I just started getting more information that I never expected to have that dovetailed with rumors that I was seeing on social media and provided detail to them. And this, I think, is kind of just, it's a history about this U.S.-Israel special relationship that's being uncovered right now that shows just how it's collapsed, is completely collapsed. Because when you lose Charlie Kirk, I don't mean physically, but when they lost him politically, or if they lost him politically, and he starts refusing your funding, refusing Netanyahu's offer to fund his organization to the hilt, which was what I told he did, then you've lost the game.
Did he refuse to fly to Israel and meet with Netanyahu?
That's what I was told, and that's what Candace Owens, who is a lot closer to Charlie Kirk than me, just said on her live stream, that he rejected that offer. So Netanyahu delivered a video eulogy to Charlie Kirk and held this letter that he said he sent him, inviting him to Israel, to Jerusalem, 2 weeks before his death. Why would you do that if Charlie Kirk refused? Like, how much of a sick sociopath do you have to be? But then again, Bill Ackman, the day after Charlie Kirk was killed, took to Twitter X to declare that he had a meal this summer with Charlie Kirk and spent time with him, and he was a giant of a man. I mean, how deranged do you have to be to say that when the reality was that this was described as an intervention in which Charlie Kirk was hammered by Bill Ackman and put under all this pressure, which poured out into that Megyn Kelly interview? I mean, we're dealing with real sociopaths here.
Max, you are second to none when it comes to the skullduggery you go through, your personal courage, and your understanding of all of these profound issues and interrelated factors here. I can't thank you enough. I know you're going to be doing some other things for a day or so, but if more of this comes out and you want this audience, please let us know. You have it at your disposal.
Let me just say one thing that I've been hearing from a Trump administration source, like someone who's in the a Trump administration official, and I've heard this from other areas close to the Trump administration, which is that they don't really feel like they're hearing enough from the FBI. The FBI is not being transparent. And that's the way that the American people feel about this. And so the longer that goes on...
Oh, transparent over what?
They're not sharing information. They're not like... They want to see like video of the muzzle flash from the roof and see where the shot came from. And since that's not forthcoming, even at the highest level, the public is becoming more, I hate to say it, but conspiratorial. And this is just going to fester until we get some answers. So what we need are answers, and we need a real investigation into this, and we need a real investigation into the Ryan Ruth assassination attempt, since he was connected to Ukraine and its International Legion and was having meetings on Capitol Hill. It's very strange how that one was buried, as well as the Butler, Pennsylvania shooting. That one just kind of went away.
Do the people in the White House fear that Robinson did not pull the trigger that propelled the fatal shot?
I think that anyone who's not getting answers, who's in the administration, has a lot of suspicion and questions about what's going on. But let me again say, I'm totally content to believe the official story if it's proven, if it's demonstrated, if we get some evidence. But where is that? And also, and additionally, I have no evidence that Israel played any role. I'm not here saying that. But consider how the public is going to react here when we live in this digital panopticon where everything around us is filmed through active or passive surveillance. Cell phones were everywhere filming Charlie Kirk along with real cameras, and we still have missing angles.
So about 2 hours ago, Dan Bongino told Fox News that they're looking for an accomplice.
I don't even know who to trust. I mean, do we trust this podcaster guy? But yeah,
he's a podcaster guy, but he's number two in the FBI.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, he's certainly
unhappy, but he's there.
And Kash Patel said that there was a manifesto left by Tyler Robinson, but it has disappeared or destroyed, and they're going to try to forensically reconstruct it. Look, everything could come together by tomorrow, but right now, there isn't enough there to clearly convict a lone wolf shooter. And therefore, the public is going to develop its own theories.
Thank you, Max. Thanks for all your work. Thanks for the privilege of having you break this news right here, a forum that is always available to you, even though you have your...
So that was posted Monday, Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano. And Max Blumenthal was giving his report on Charlie Kirk, what he's found out so far. So that this is entirely different than anything I've heard in the media and either print or electronic. Of course, I don't follow everything, but...
It's ironic, at least, that the immediate response from Netanyahu, not really mentioned by Max there, but was before anybody said anything publicly, to deny that Israel was behind the assassination. Like, my lady doth protest too much, as Shakespeare said. But I want to point to the larger context here, which is the outlaw tandem nations of U.S. and Israel, which are increasingly violating the norms as well as international laws and increasing our own, both countries' isolation in the international realm. So aside from, you know, the possible role in assassinations and assassination attempts in this country, I remember such things as Soleimani, the most popular politician in Iran, was on a mission to, a breakthrough mission to talk to Saudi Arabia, and was killed, again, by U.S.-Israel forces in Baghdad, a blatant international assassination carried out there. And then there was the attack on the Iranian negotiators after the U.S. had led them on to say, okay, we'll see you Monday. And then on Friday, there was this tremendous attack, again, a U.S.-Israel combined operation that killed families and others, some of the negotiators. And before that, of course, you know, they killed nuclear scientists as well. So there's, again, another blatant terrorist attack by Israel. So these are the context why people might think Israel would do carry out other such crimes. And then more recently, of course, one of the most outrageous of all these is the Doha negotiators from Hamas had been lured there by the U.S. on promises of more negotiations, and they were attacked and some of them killed along with civilians and their families. So I'm pointing to the fact that Israel joined at the hip with the United States as an outlaw nation, and so you can understand why people would believe them capable of most any kind of murderous act. Look at what they're doing in Gaza every day.
It's hard to believe that the world can watch a genocide in action. You know, the history of Hamas is interesting because Hamas was promoted by the West back in the early 2000s as a counterweight to get the Palestine Authority to go against them.
Yeah, divide and rule. They've never supported a Palestinian state, and one of the ways to divide the Palestinians was to support Hamas, which they did.
And so Hamas took over, and maybe it was a little bit bloody. They threw some members of the Palestine Authority off of a roof just to make sure that they went away. And And then, starting about 2008, about every 2 years, Israel started attacking. And this time, they upped what was going on. 2008 was memorable that they took out the water purification, these towers. They just blew them up, and they've never allowed them to be rebuilt. And then there's about every 2 years there's another Israeli attack. And then about 2018 going into 2019, Hamas came up with this nonviolent Great March of Return. Now, they marched from where the people of in Gaza were living back to the wall, and where just beyond that, many of the people had lived there up until the Great Nakba, when the Israel was formed, and all these Palestinians were forced out of their lands where they historically been, and so they were marching on the wall, and Israeli sharpshooters on the wall took great delight in shooting them in the knees, shooting them in the legs, shooting them. The world didn't criticize Hamas for this nonviolent direct action thing. They didn't criticize Israel either, by any means. And so it was a time when they did this big, entirely different kind of action, where they breached the wall, Israeli wall, and went in and took hostages and the like. And so it's been this whole history, which they've just, in some ways, being manipulated, being an excuse to do this or do that by the Israeli armed forces, and all along supported by the United States of America.
Yeah, Israel, once again, on outlaw nation status, I'm ascribing to them. They've been attacking nations in like six or seven places in just the past 2-3 weeks. Tunis, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Iran. I probably skipped one. So this is the kind of joint policy U.S. and Israel are pursuing.
And they are, in Lebanon, they continue to break the agreement of January 2025 when they stopped the war, and they keep expanding out, and they keep demolishing more and more homes for people who live there. I've seen a number of television reports on recently on that, and it's the United States never says anything, so it just creates this more and more enmity of against Israel, and Israel actually just is wanting to build greater Israel, ersatz Israel, and they will expand.
They're encountering so much hostility that just a couple of days ago, Netanyahu declared that Israel now is the new Sparta. And if you know your history, that's not a nice prospect. And basically going to try to be self-reliant on in military and other matters, which is totally unrealistic without the U.S. But at any rate, they have a hunker-down mentality there in the face of increased international hostility.
So we are in our pledge drive here at KFEI, 612-375-9030, 612-375-9030, or KFEI.org, you can pledge there too. Well, Dave, we can play it. We got a little bit of time. We could play some of last week's show with Brian Berletic on the NATO panels. panics as Ukraine frontline collapses, with Professor Glenn Deason. And Brian Berletic is a former U.S. Marine journalist and international security analyst. This was posted on September 9th.
Brian's site is called The New Atlas, for those who want to check him out. He's quite informative, especially on the military side of things. U.S. Citizen and veteran, but now based in Thailand.
But you mentioned that the next step, as the front lines, I guess anyone paying close attention see that this is falling apart. What's possible now for the West to do? You mentioned the possibility of direct intervention. Do you see NATO countries beginning to send their troops directly in? Because I think, as you mentioned before, the United States would prefer if the Europeans join in on, you know, fighting to the last man. But how capable are the Europeans, besides from weak government? The French, Germans, British government, they all seem to be competing for who can be the most unpopular and economically weak now, it seems. So how credible is it that the Europeans can actually send troops in?
Well, I don't think that's any more credible than the idea of Ukraine stopping the Russians. I think the United States just sees Europe as an extension of this proxy war, expendable proxies that they can send in to extend the duration of this conflict and raise the cost for Russia. The entirety of this conflict, going all the way back to 2014, Europe was clearly expendable in every sense, not just in the sense of we're forcing them to invest heavily in Ukraine, but the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines, cutting all of Europe off from cheap, affordable Russian energy. And then when you really think about it, before 2014, Russia was no threat to Europe in any shape, form, or way. They were cooperating closely together. They depended on each other. As you say, that you have to align interests, and this is how you achieve peace. And that was already achieved between Europe and Russia. It was the United States who forced this issue, who forced Europe and Russia apart. And they didn't do this by forcing the governments in Europe to go along. In a sense, they did. But the very creation of the European Union as a layer of bureaucracy thrown over the individual European states themselves smothers their sovereignty. This is a bureaucracy that answers to the same special interests driving U.S. foreign policy. And because of that, these governments in power and interlocking with the European Union were making decisions that were demonstrably opposed to the best interests of these European states and all of the people living within their borders. So you look at Germany right now, the state that they are in economically and politically. You just mentioned the political instability in France, which I think ultimately doesn't matter, because if you look at the leading parties in all of these countries, it's exactly like in the United States. They pose as having differing ideologies and agendas, but at the end of the day, once they worm their way into power, they go along with the program. I remember a lot of people invested hope in the Italian Meloni, and thinking that she would, and she had said things before she got into office that she was going to put her foot down and stop all of this, except as soon as she got into office, she continued all of it. So this is how the West deals with the public. They create a strategy of tension, the socio-political, ideological strategy of tension. They control all of the major players, and they can direct where it goes, and they can ensure continuity of agenda no matter which ideology is prevailing at any given time. And I'm afraid that this is going to work in Germany, no matter who gets into office. And again, I was listening to the Duran, and they were talking about the Power Siberia 2 pipeline and how this cements the flow of Russian energy eastward instead of westward. So Europe, even if they do somehow have a revolution and break free of American hegemony, that energy is gone and it's not coming back. And so the possibility of repairing the damage that's been done because of this, that prospect is so minuscule. And I'm afraid that the U.S. sees this. They see Europe as in a declining state, and they just see, well, if we use them as proxies now, they'll be more powerful this year than they will next year. Next year, they'll be even weaker. Let's use them while we still can. Let's use them while they still have some strength. And it's not about whether European troops can go into Ukraine and defeat the Russians. It's about doing the exact same thing the Ukrainian military itself has done. Just draw it out, raise the cost, tie Russia down while the United States addresses China, Iran. Now we have Venezuela and all the other places the U.S. seeks to reassert hegemony. Hold them for at least that long, and then we can circle back around and get Russia later. So that's what Europe represents to the United States.
I just want to remind people, as I did on a prior show, that this strategy of undermining Europe's dependence on Russia or any kind of economic integration with Russia is a very long-term thing. First written about in a book by Anthony Blinken back in the 1980s, and the first Siberian pipeline was damaged severely through a very roundabout, nefarious software, malware, and collusion that eventually wound up in the Russian pipeline. So that happened way back in the late 80s, and so a forecast of what happened when we destroyed the Nord Stream pipelines 3 years ago. But I also want to just add that Angela Merkel, who at least until recently was one of the more respected German chancellors of recent decades, had to argue and fight vociferously to get Nord Stream 1 approved when she was chancellor, because the U.S. and the West was opposed to it for all the reasons we're talking about. So she had to fight hard and put her foot down and to get that pipeline through. And there were similar arguments with Nord Stream 2, which of course never got fully operational because we blew it up. And one more note about that is that Sikorsky, who's a leading warmonger and part of the globalist crowd in Europe, and he's been all kinds of things in the Polish government, foreign minister, defense minister, interior minister. You know, he's on the merry-go-round, so he's an important figure there. And the day after, within a day of the Nord Stream pipeline being blown up, a tremendous ecological disaster as well as an act of terrorism against the infrastructure of a supposed ally, he posted on social media a big picture showing the enormous methane gas bubble hitting the surface of the blue ocean and put a one-line text saying, "Thank you, USA."
Yes, that's then-President Joe Biden told a news gathering, the Nord Stream pipeline will never operate. He was pushed on it, and he said, it just never will. Well.
And Chancellor Scholz was standing humbly next to him without saying a damn thing because he's being humiliated.
Chancellor Scholz of Germany, and Germany has been all along building their economic wherewithal on the cheap Russian oil and gas, cheaper than they were able to get elsewhere. So when they blew up the pipeline, we assume it's the U.S. or maybe some Nordic countries are in there too, but the U.S. said, "Well, we'll sell you some liquefied natural gas that we've got from fracking in this in North America, but it's at 3 times the price, and it's part of the reason why Germany's been going through economic travails."
It's deindustrializing, happening in front of the world's eyes. 2 years now of recession by normal economic measurements. 2 years economics in Germany had been shrinking because of this lack of cheap fuel, which has driven their industrialization.
And this is why there's, among other reasons, the growth of alternatives for Germany, political party, is tied a lot to the influx of refugees, and then, but the decline of economic has always been a way of many of the Germans changing their political outlook.
a better option, but less popular at this point, is Sarah Wagenknecht, who I like because she has the same last name spelling as Gutknecht, and she's got the true vision of quasi-socialist, populist, democratic future for the country.
So we can do a few more minutes, but give us a call, pledge today, 612-375-9030. We have been trying to present all these different arguments, histories, about what has been going on in Europe with the Ukraine, how the whole thing with NATO has developed.
Then the other argument is against the AfD, the right wing, especially strong in what was Eastern Germany, is to see that their candidates die off. For some reason, six or seven of them affiliated with AfD have died in the past 3 weeks leading up to an election. Extreme coincidence.
Extreme coincidence. So let's hear a little more Brian Berletic being interviewed by Professor Glenn Deason.
To perform strategic sequencing.
Yeah, once when he was NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, he went to the United States and he was trying to sell the war as, because people were losing some interest, the public, and he was trying to sell the war as a great advantage because the U.S. would have all this, hundreds of thousands of battle-hardened Ukrainian soldiers being able to contain Russia, so the U.S. could focus on China. So, more or less, what you were saying. But now, of course, it's strange to me that the Europeans do not see that they may take over that role of the Ukrainians, someone to be used as a proxy to throw at Russia. That is, they're already fighting this war to the last euro. If they would start to enter some military force as well, then of course it would get much, much worse. Just on the economic part, this is very strange because there, you mentioned that there's economic interdependence between the Europeans and Russians, but often what countries seek to do is have asymmetrical interdependence to make sure that they depend on you don't depend on them. And in 2014, the Europeans were in a good position. There was mutual dependence. However, the Russians were using our technologies, our industries, our transportation corridors, our ports and all, our banks, the SWIFT payment system, our currencies in international trade. So they were very dependent on us. What we were dependent on them was energy security, to have energy supplies. But even on this, the Russians were dependent on Europe as an energy consumer. So we hadn't, the balance was very much in our favor. But as you said, now the Russians have decoupled completely due to weaponization. So all the influence we had in the past, I think, is long gone. Just a last question. In terms of...
So that is Professor Glenn Deason talking with Brian Berletic. Brian is a former U.S. Marine. Now he's a journalist and international security analyst. And this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show. Your host, Don Olson, and Dave Gudnick here. And it's coming up. It's time for Global Beat.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
In the 1980s, Minnesota's very own Orfield Laboratories acquired a unique gem, an anechoic chamber from Sunbeam's Chicago facilities. Utilizing the help from the University of Chicago's football team, Stephen J. Orfield was able to transport the extremely heavy parts all the way to Minnesota. The chamber was designed to absorb 99.99% of sound, which is very, very quiet.
It's so quiet, one might say you could hear a pin.
If you plan on visiting the anechoic chamber, make sure to lay or sit down when you enter the room. It's said that when you're inside, you can hear your own heartbeat, your bones creak, and even your blood flowing. The lack of noise could also cause a feeling that you're falling. Many visitors say they start to feel claustrophobic and can usually only last up to 20 minutes before starting to feel a little uneasy. Stephen's acquisition of the anechoic chamber not only enriched the laboratory's legacy, but it's also left an impact on the world of acoustics and how scientists and sound engineers perceive sound forever.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.